I don't know what they promised we're giving out at this class, but I'm flattered that you're all here. In any case, my name is Zev Leff. I am the Rav of Moshav Matityahu and the Rosh Yeshiva of the Yeshiva there. I've been teaching in Michlala for many, many years, and it's very possible that I had some of your mothers. If by chance I had some of your grandmothers, don't tell me. Okay. This class may be, yes. When there's something to hear, I will speak louder. This class may be a little different than the others that you have, insofar that you will not have any tests in this class. No reports, avodot. I just expect you to be here with your eyes open and listening. I don't demand that you take notes. If taking notes will make you concentrate better and remember what I said, then fine, take them. If taking notes will ensure that the piece of paper in front of you has what I said and your minds will be blank, then I have plenty of words of Torah on pieces of paper. I don't need more. Whatever will enhance your hearing and remembering what I'm going to say is what I want. Very soon, in the next few years for sure, for all of you, you are not going to have grades. Grades are not the ikkar in this world. If you marry someone who grades you, don't marry him. And the main grades are what kind of person you are and what you do throughout your life, and the Rabban Shalom will grade you at the proper time. And therefore, it's a good idea, perhaps, at some point in your education to have a class that doesn't have grades, or that doesn't have tests, and has grades. The grades you'll get, no matter what. If you're here and your eyes are open, you will get the highest grade you can get. So the grade you're going to get just by being here. So you might as well listen also. The reason for tests are twofold. One is to give you the incentive to listen. You are responsible young women who are here because you want to be here. You don't have to be here altogether. You didn't have to come to Eretz Yisrael to Michlala. If you wanted to, you could have stayed home. You surely did not have to come to this class. So if you're here, you're here because you want to be here. So I don't have to give you an incentive to listen. And the only other reason for tests is that it gives you an incentive to review and remember every detail. The pressure of having to review for a test puts the material into your head in a way that you remember the details better. I don't really care if you remember every detail that I'm going to tell you. I don't remember every detail I'm going to tell you. I'm just concerned that you remember the basic ideas and that you file them away somewhere in your neshama for the future. So with that understood, we will start the class. We're going to pick topics from the weekly Sedra. And obviously we're not going to go through the whole Sedra, but try to pick some topics that represent at least a good portion of inyanim, of hashkafa, or whatever, musar from the Sedra. The proper designation is the Sedra, not the Parsha. Even though there are all these Parshos HaShavua, if you want to call it that, you have to call it Parshios HaShavua. A Parsha is a paragraph in the Torah. A Sedra is made up of many Parshios. So it's either the Parshios HaShavua or it's the Sedra of the Shavua. Let's start from the beginning. V'hoya kisov el ha'aretz. The Torah prefaces the mitzvah of Bikurim with V'hoya kisov el ha'aretz. First of all, the Orachayim HaKadosh says, based on Chazal, that V'hoya is Lashon Simcha. Whenever it says V'hoya, it's Simcha. Vayehi is Lashon Tzora. V'hoya kisov el ha'aretz ein Simcha ela b'yeshivas ha'aretz. Real simcha can only be had when we are settled in Eretz Yisrael. One simple idea, what he's saying is that until we'll be settled in Eretz Yisrael, Mashiach will come, there won't be full simcha in the world, and he brings down the pasuk, Oz Yemalei Schok Pinu. But even more than that, settling in Eretz Yisrael has to bring a person simcha. You have to be happy about it. We're not going to discuss now why, but that is one of the tznayim of living in Eretz Yisrael, that a person should be besimcha. Partially, a very simple idea is, the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael is settling Eretz Yisrael, being settled in Eretz Yisrael. You can't be settled physically unless you are settled mentally. And if you're not happy, you're not settled. So in order to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, you have to be miyushav. You have to be settled. In order to be settled, you have to be happy. So in any case, there's this happiness of settling Eretz Yisrael, Kisov El Ha'aretz, says the Medrash the following. Asei mitzvah zu. If you will fulfill this mitzvah of Bikurim, Bavur Shetikonsu La'aretz. In order that you should be able to enter Eretz Yisrael and conquer it and settle it, do this mitzvah. This mitzvah will be a segula for you to conquer and settle Eretz Yisrael. There's only one big problem with that medrash. This mitzvah did not start till 14 years after they got into Eretz Yisrael. 7 years it took to conquer the land, 7 years to divide it up and settle it, and only then, things that grew from that point on were Chayiv and Bikurim. So they already conquered and settled Eretz Yisrael for 14 years before they ever did this mitzvah to begin with. How could this mitzvah be the cause to be able to enter and settle Eretz Yisrael if it never didn't happen till after they did it? One way of understanding this is a tremendous implications for this time of year. And that is something that Shari Tshuva says, Legabe Tshuva. He says that the first stage of Tshuva is accepting upon yourself that you're going to do Tshuva. When you come to the realization that you really should do Tshuva, whether you come to that realization on your own, whether you come to that realization because you are inspired by somebody who inspires you, then as soon as you make the decision and you are makabel on yourself that you're going to start the process of tshuva, it's considered like you did it. The Meiri says that as soon as a person is makabel on himself to do tshuva, his status changes. And he's already called a chassid. The second before, he could have been a rasha. But as soon as he accepts upon himself to do tshuva, he hasn't done anything yet. But he makes a commitment. That commitment changes his status, which explains the following Mishnah. The Mishnah says that if a man gives a woman keset kedushin on condition, he says, Hareat Mikudeshasli, Al Menash Ani Tzadik Gomer. I'm marrying you on one condition, that I'm a Tzadik Gomer. Even if at this moment he's a Rasha Gomer, we know the guy is a Rasha. The Kedushin is a doubtful Kedushin. Maybe she's married. Why? We know the guy's a Rasha. Shema Hira Tshuva Belibo. Maybe he had thoughts of Tshuva in his heart. So they ask on that, so what if he had thoughts of tshuva in his heart? you're not mekayim the mitzvah of tshuva unless you say vidui. You had to say something. We didn't hear him say anything. He just stood there like a golem. Secondly, there are many averis that unless you correct them, you can't do tshuva. For instance, maybe this guy stole things. If you don't return the stolen articles, you can't do tshuva. It's impossible to do tshuva before you return the stolen articles. So what do we care if the guy thought about doing tshuva? He couldn't have possibly fulfilled the mitzvah of tshuva completely unless he said something and did things. So why is there even a doubt about the Kedushin? He's still a Rasha. He obviously didn't say anything. He didn't do anything. All he did maybe was think about doing tshuva. But according to this Meiri, it answers the question. True. In order to fulfill the mitzvah of tshuva, in order to totally exonerate yourself from the Avera, you have to do things, you have to say things. But to change your status, to be called a tzaddik, as opposed to be called a Rasha, just accepting and committing yourself is enough. As long as the commitment is a strong commitment. We'll see in a few seconds what that means. Where do we see this? Where's the source for this idea that committing yourself to something as if you did it already? The Medrash says, Moshe Rabbeinu commanded Klal Yisrael of all the halachas of Korban Pesach. He did it on Rosh Chodesh Nisan. They had 2 weeks until they actually brought Korban Pesach. Immediately after Moshe Rabbeinu told them on Rosh Chodesh all the halachas, the Torah says, Vayelchu vayasu b'nei Yisrael. They went and they did it. So the Medrash says, what did they do? They didn't do anything till the 14th. 2 weeks later. What's Vayelchu vayasu? They went and they did. Elakivan shikiblu aleihem lasos, ma'ala aleihem akosu kilu asu. Since they accepted upon themselves to do, the Torah considers if they did it. You accept something, you commit yourself to something, your status changes already. It's considered like you did it already. The Shari Tshuva explains a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos based on this. The Mishnah says, Kol shemaisav merube mechachmaso, chachmaso ein chachmaso miskayemes. Whoever does more than he knows, his chachma will remain. Says the Shari Tshuva, how could you do more than you know? It's an impossibility. How can you possibly do what you don't know? Says the Shari Tshuva, if a person says, I accept upon myself to do whatever I will be taught is the proper thing to do. I don't know all the mitzvahs. I don't know all the halachas. But I'm mekabel on myself to do it. When I'll learn it, then as soon as you make the kabbalah, it's as if you did it. So therefore, your maisim are merubim. You know, I don't know what it is, but it's already like I did it. So I can do more than I know because the commitment is already considered like you did it. And there's a special bracha for a person who makes that commitment. Unfortunately, there's a special klala for a person who doesn't make that commitment. It's in this week's Eddie, later on. Baruch asher yokim es divrei ha-Torah hazos la so so so. It's not a bracha for somebody who observes the Torah. It's a bracha for somebody asher yokim. Yokim means I commit myself. I accept upon myself to do it. There's a special bracha for the commitment. And orer asher lo yokim. There's a special klala for somebody who doesn't commit himself to keeping the Torah. Even if he does it. But he's not committed. Special klala. So the commitment is very, very important. How strong does the commitment have to be? So here is a little bit deflating. The Rambam says that the commitment not to do an Aveira again, which is one of the parts of tshuva, has to be so strong, asher yoid olav yodea talumos, that the Rabbanu Shlom, who knows everything that's hidden, can testify that you'll never do that Aveira again. That's how strong the commitment has to be. So strong that, on the other hand, that you will do it for sure. Or when it's something wrong, that you won't do it for sure. Now that's very scary, because that seems to imply that if you ever do the Aveira again, you didn't do tshuva. And the Mela, if you don't end up fulfilling your commitment, then your commitment was worthless. But it's not like that. Because if that would be the case, why does God have to get involved in testifying anything? If you want to know if you did tshuva or not, all you have to do is wait till you end your life, look back, and see if you ever did the Aveira again. If you did it again, you know you didn't do tshuva. If you never did it again, you know you did do tshuva. Why does God have to get involved? And if the idea is you want to know now if your commitment was strong enough to be tshuva, God doesn't tell you. So what does it help? The Ribbono Shel Olam knows. What does that help you? So why does the Rambam say the Ribbono Shel Olam has to testify? Why does the Ribbono Shel Olam have to get involved? It should say that you'll never do the Aveira again. So the Mefarshei HaRambam explained the following, and it applies to our situation also, the same kind of commitment. Let's say it's Ne'ilah Yom Kippur, and you've really had a successful Elul and Aseres Yemei Tshuva, and you really, really mean it. When at Ne'ilah you finally come to the commitment and the Kabbalah Al Ha'asid that you're never going to speak Lashon Hara again. You really mean it. And if your neighbor behind you in shul will tap you on the shoulder at that moment, the middle of Ne'ilah, you just said, Dibarnu Dofi, and you said, that's it, I will never speak Lashon Hara again. She taps you on the shoulder and she says, want to hear something real juicy about so-and-so? At that moment, you would punch her in the mouth and say, I don't want to ever hear Lashon Hara again, leave me alone. And you really mean it. And if you could freeze that moment in time, you never would speak Lashon Hara again. Unfortunately, the next morning, your neighbor calls you on the phone and says, no, now do you want to hear? And you hem and haw, and finally you give in. Two possibilities. One is that yesterday at Ne'ilah, you didn't really mean it. And that's why today, you gave in. There's another possibility. You really meant it. And if you could freeze that moment in time and you never would change from what you were at Ne'ilah, you never would have done the Aveira again. But the next morning, you already fell down from that Madrega. You're a different person. But had you frozen that moment in time, you really meant it. And if that's the case, then you did tshuva. And this is a new thing. Only God knows that. There's no way of anybody, even yourself, knowing whether the reason you ended up doing the Aveira again is because your commitment at the time of the tshuva wasn't strong, or because circumstances changed. Only the Ribbono Shel Olam can know that. That's what the Rambam says. Same thing over here. If you made a strong commitment, that at the moment you made the commitment, you would have done that mitzvah. You would have not done what you made the commitment not to do. But then circumstances changed, then your status changed at that moment. Changed back later on. But at that moment, you were a tzaddik. And it's considered like you did the mitzvah, and you committed yourself to the Torah. All of that applies if your commitment was strong, even if in the end, you didn't end up actually accomplishing it. It's possible. In addition, though, in order to make sure that your commitment is strong and effective, it's not enough just to say, I'm going to do it. But how are you going to ensure that you'll do it? What steps are you going to take to avoid the pitfalls of not doing it? So when you are makabel on yourself, whatever the Kabbalah may be, right, so then you should think in your mind, how am I going to anticipate the problems that come up and take those problems into consideration and do things that will enable me to keep my commitment? For instance, right, let's say that you're committing yourself not to eat something not kosher anymore. right? You have this great appetite, and you just can't control yourself. And every time you pass Luigi's restaurant, you go in and have a pizza with sausages, okay, which is happens to be Trey. You can't control yourself. So one day you decide that's it. No more pizza with sausages. I'm not going into Luigi's. But how am I going to control myself? So I decide that from now on, whenever I have to get to point B, I'm not going to go on that block. I'm going to walk on a different block. And that way, I don't have the nisoyan. So I've done something that will ensure my commitment that I have a better chance of fulfilling it. So it's not just a empty commitment. It's a commitment with teeth in it. That also is part of the commitment. Or in this case, commitment without teeth in it, or whatever. In any case, so therefore, that's what the Medrash says. The Medrash says, do this mitzvah, and in the schus of this mitzvah, you're going to Eretz Yisrael. We didn't fulfill the mitzvah until 14 years after we already were settled in Eretz Yisrael. What it means is, if when you come to conquer Eretz Yisrael, you accept upon yourself that when you'll have your first fruits, you're going to bring it to the Ribono Shel Olam, then the commitment to fulfill this mitzvah will already be the schus to be able to conquer and settle Eretz Yisrael. Not the actual performance of the mitzvah. But asei mitzvah zu means commit yourself. That you're conquering it, you're putting in a lot of work, effort, danger in conquering Eretz Yisrael. You're splitting it up and dividing it and settling it and putting a lot of effort into settling Eretz Yisrael. But if you have in mind, when you do all of that, it's not yours. If the Ribono Shel Olam is giving you a present and you're willing to bring him Bikurim and you commit yourself to that, that schus of the commitment will give you the schus to conquer and settle Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Next. Any questions on that? Okay. Let's go on to the next one. The mitzvah of Bikurim is one of many mitzvahs where HaKadosh Baruch Hu demands from us the first. Bring me the first. First fruits, firstborn, the first shearings of the wool, right? Reishis Hagez, Truma, Chala is called Reishis Arisoseichem. Now, I am a firstborn. So I have no trouble believing that the first is the best. How many of you are not firstborn? Wow. Do you agree with me? I didn't think so. And honestly speaking, you may be right. The first is not always the best. In my case, it's not that way. But in any case, it may be that the first is not the best. So why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu say that we should bring the first? Why didn't he say, you know what, bring a few samples, first, second, third, and the best of the all of them, bring me. Why Dafka the first? One of the answers to that question, there are others. One of the answers to that question is that the first is the root and the foundation of everything that follows. You build on that first. It forms the root and the foundation. And if there is a blemish in the root or the foundation, it is much more serious than a blemish in the continuation of the building or the plant. If there's a hairline crack in the foundation of a building, the whole building's going to fall through. But if there's a hairline crack on the eighth floor, it's not going to make too much of a difference. If there is a blemish in the root of a plant, it's going to come out 1,000 times in the plant itself. And that same blemish on a leaf is not going to make any difference. So when you are creating the foundation and the root of everything that comes afterwards, it has to be as perfect as possible, and therefore you dedicate the firsts, to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in order to make it Kodesh Kadoshim. So that what follows after that first is at least Kodesh, is at least used in a proper way, because it's built. Let me give you two examples where we see this idea. One is the following. Let's take the positive example first. Reb Chiya. The Gemara says that Reb Chiya said that if the Torah would be forgotten, he has a plan to revive the Torah. What would he do? He would go and plant flax, linen. When it grew, he would harvest it and make ropes out of it. From the ropes, he would make nets. With the nets, he would capture deer. The deer he would shecht, take the hides and make it into parchment, and the skin, the flesh he would give to poor people. He would take the parchment and write Chamisha Chumshei Torah on it. He would go from city to city, teach five young men, each one a different Chumash, six other young men, each one a different Seder Mishnah, and then tell them, teach the others what they learned. And that way the Torah would be revived. So everybody asks, I understand if it's a time when the Torah is forgotten, there are no bookstores. You can't go into a bookstore and buy a Chumash. So you have to write the Chumash. But nobody is selling nets. Nobody's selling parchment. Why don't you just go and buy parchment? Why does he have to go and plant linen, make his own nets, catch the deer, and make parchment? Go buy parchment. The answer is, since we're talking about a time the Torah was forgotten, and it has to be revived and reinstated, we're talking about creating the foundation and the root for all future Torah. Then even the parchment that you write the Chumashim on has to be done l'shem shamayim. Even the nets that you catch the deer had to be planted l'shem shamayim. Because when you're talking about the root and the foundation, it has to be as perfect as possible. Now the negative side. Where do you see that it works the other way? Acher. Elisha ben Avuya, who was called Acher, went off the derech. So our Gemara tells us some of the things that happened to Elisha ben Avuya that caused him to go off the derech. One of them was, he saw, this also has to do with the last week, etc. He saw a father tell his son to climb up a ladder and bring him some bird's eggs. So the son climbed up the ladder, sent away the mother to mekayim the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein, brought him the bird's eggs. On his way down from the ladder, he fell off the ladder and got killed. So he says, it's impossible. The Torah promises Arichas Yamim for the mitzvah of Shiluach HaKein and the mitzvah of Kibbud Av. This guy was doing both of those mitzvahs. Where's his Arichas Yamim? He's a kid. He fell off the ladder and got killed. Les din v'les, I don't believe anymore. He went up the derech. And then the Gemara gives other things that he saw. He saw the tongue of Chutzpis HaMeturgeman dragged by a pig after he was murdered by the Romans. Chutzpis HaMeturgeman was the person who conveyed the shiurim of all the Tanoim. And his tongue was desecrated by a pig. He said, I can't believe anymore. That's our Gemara. The Yerushalmi says a different thing, that Acher's problem happened way before that. The day of his bris, Acher himself, his father made a big party. His father was one of the richest and most distinguished people in Yerushalayim. So at his bris, he invited all the Chachamim, all the big Talmidei Chachamim, and all the rich people of Yerushalayim, made a gala bris. So the rich people were eating and drinking and dancing and enjoying the bris. And the Talmidei Chachamim said, look, they're enjoying it their way, let's enjoy it our way. So they started to learn. And they went from Torah to Nevi'im, and Nevi'im to Ksuvim, and then they went to Torah Shebaal Peh. And they were learning with such fervor and intensity that a fire came down in Hashemayim and surrounded them. So Avuya came over to them. He said, what are you trying to do, burn down my house? What are you bringing fires into my house? He said, don't worry, it's a spiritual fire. It's the fire of Har Sinai. We were learning with such intensity that we brought down the fire of Har Sinai. He said, wow, that's the power that people have who learned Torah have to bring down the fire from Har Sinai, right? The fire from heaven. If that's the case, I want my son to learn Torah so he could bring fire from the heavens. And since his entire foundation and root of learning Torah was not l'shem shamayim, but was in order to bring fire min hashamayim, so that's why he ended up the way he did. Now, he could have changed that. And even though we say mitosha lo lishma bo lishma, that's where you learn Torah because it's Torah, but you do it for an ulterior motive too. I want covet or whatever. But when you totally distort the Torah, Torah is not something to bring fire, min hashamayim. That's not what Torah is. Then the foundation and the root are blemished. Now, he could have changed it and started again. Could have done tshuva. When he grew up, he could have learned Torah differently. He never did. And there's no contradiction between the two Gemaras. Because when your foundation is crooked and the root is blemished, everything that comes out is crooked. And you see the whole world crooked. Acher's nephew, Rabbi Yaakov, saw the same maisa with the guy falling off the ladder. And he came to a different conclusion. Not that I don't believe. Not that there's no justice in this world and there's no judge. He came to the conclusion that Schar Mitzvah, Bahayal Malekah, that when God promised long life, he didn't mean in this world. No matter how long you live, it's not that long. He means eternal life. He's talking about Olam Haba. Why didn't Acher come to that conclusion? Because his whole foundation in Torah was crooked. He was looking for bringing fire of Min HaShemayim, not for Olam Haba. So therefore, he saw things in a crooked way. That is the idea of firsts. The firsts are important because they form the root and the foundation, and if you dedicate them to the Ribbono Shel Olam, whatever they may be, right, Pidyon HaBen, whatever it may be, right, then you've created a foundation and a root that is as perfect as possible, that what follows then can be at least built on something close to perfection. But it doesn't have to be as perfect, which answers the following question, which should bother you. I'm sure you've learned already, maybe, in another class, you're learning halacha, that during Aseres Yemei Tshuva, a person should be frumer than the rest of the year. And one of the examples the Shulchan Aruch brings is, if you eat pas palter a whole year, which is mutter, but not l'mahadrin, during Aseres Yemei Tshuva, you shouldn't eat it. The example, Drake's cakes, okay? Still remember what they were, but in any case, Drake's cakes are not pas palter, okay? Pas Yisrael, okay? Pas Yisrael is where a Jew at least caused somewhat the baking of those things. Things that are baked commercially in Goyisha factories usually are very difficult to be Pas Yisrael. I used to be the Mashgiach in Florida for Arnold's bread, for the Chaf Kei. And the Rabbi Center once asked me, he wanted to make Arnold's bread Pas Yisrael. So he told me, next time you go to the plant, you should ask the manager if you can turn off the oven, let it cool down, and turn it back on. So all the bread they bake from that point on comes from what you turned on the oven, and we can publicize that Arnold's bread is Pas Yisrael. So I did that. Next time I went over to the manager of the plant and asked him, can I turn off the oven and let it cool down and turn it back on? After he's finished laughing for about 5 minutes, the oven they had there was about the size of this room, maybe three times the size of this room. That was the oven that they had for baking Arnold's bread. It was like the size of a block, a city block. You went in one, you put the things in one, went on a conveyor belt till the other side. He said, we haven't turned this oven off in 25 years. If you turn it off, right, we will not be able to turn it on for another month or two, right? You are not turning this oven off and cooling it off and turning it back on, right? And that was the end of that. So in most places, it's very difficult to have Pas Yisrael in very big Goyish concerns. So Drake's cakes are not Pas Yisrael. So how do we eat them? Pas Akum is Osir, and Pas Bishal Akum is Osir, but Pas Palter is different. Pas Palter is bread baked commercially by a non-Jew. If your neighbor bakes you challahs, not commercially, as a private person, and you have a mashgiach watching him, bought new kalim, and every ingredient is glatt kosher, it's treif, you can't eat it, because the goy baked it. But if it's done by a commercial baker, and there's a mashgiach who sees that all the ingredients are kosher, And all the kalim are kosher. The only problem is that it was baked from beginning to end by a goy is kosher. But it's not mahadrin. Meaning, if you have bread baked by a Jew of a similar quality and price, you should eat that. But if this is of a superior quality, the one baked by the goy, or it's cheaper, you're allowed to eat it. It's not, again, mahadrin, but it's okay. It's kosher. So somebody who eats Drake's cakes a whole year, Aser Shemei Tshuva, should be machmir and not eat it. Now, I would understand that halacha if it referred to the following. You know, this year I think I'm going to become frumer. So I'm going to try out for Aser Shemei Tshuva not eating Drake's cakes and see if I can do it. And if I can do it, I won't eat it the whole year. Then I understand. I'm trying Aser Shemei Tshuva to up my observance of the Torah. But it's not talking about that. It's talking where I have absolutely no intention of stopping eating Drake's cakes in the coming year. Except Aser Shemei Tshuva, I'm going to stop. I already have an order in for Motzoi Yom Kippur to break my fast on Drake's cakes. There's no way in the world I'm stopping to eat Drake's cakes. But during Aser Shemei Tshuva, I'm not going to eat them. Who are you fooling? What are we doing, fooling the Ribbono Shel Olam? During Aser Shemei Tshuva, we're being judged. I don't eat Drake's cakes. I'm really from Motzoi Yom Kippur. I say, fooled you, God. I'm not that from, right? But you're finished. The din's over. Tough luck. What are we fooling? And it's not like Drake's cakes. People daven with extra kavana during us. They give more tztaka. Who are we fooling? If you plan to do that the rest of the year is one thing, but if you know you will never daven like that the rest of the year, then what are you putting on the act? Because it's Aser Shemei Tshuva? Because it's Elul? Different God for Elul? A different God for Aser Shemei? Ever bother you? So let me tell you, it shouldn't bother you. Because just like the first are the foundation and root for everything that follows, the first of the year is also like that. Rosh Hashanah is called Reishis Hashanah. And those 10 days are the root and foundation of the coming year. Let me ask you, if somebody is building a house and he can use grade A cement or grade B cement, grade A cement costs double what grade B cement costs. He can't afford to put grade A cement in the whole house. But he blows and buys grade A cement for the foundation. Is he a faker? Does it make sense? Yeah. I can't afford to put it into the whole building. It's not possible. But at least the foundation should be grade A, because if the foundation is grade B, the building has less of a chance of standing. So there is something to putting in better materials in the foundation than what you put in on what you build on that foundation. So if Aser Shemei Tshuva, and it already starts with a preparation of Elul, is a foundation and root for the entire year, then it is not false to daven better during those days, to give more tzedakah during those days, to make sure that what you do is of a greater quality than you do the rest of the year. Because you're not trying to fool the Ribbono Shel Olam, but you're trying to create a foundation and root for your entire year that you may know you may not be able to keep up the rest of the year. But at least the foundation and root were as perfect as possible, so what you build on it is going to be better. Because if the foundation and the root are shaky and inferior, then what chance is there that the rest of the building is going to be anything? So there is nothing false about putting in extra effort during this time of year, even if you know that there's no way you can continue it after Yom Kippur. Still, there's something to do with, because this creates the foundation and the root. Okay. Next. What time does this class go to? Anybody know? What? 45? Oh, okay, good. So I have about 10 more things, and we're not going to get to all of them, but there's something. Okay. Let's skip a little bit. I have another thing about Bikurim, but we'll leave that for some other time. Okay. The next parsha in this Sedra is the parsha of Vidui Meiser. In a nutshell, what it is the following. You have a cycle of Maisris. The first 2 years of the Shemitah cycle, you separate two Maisris, Maisr Rishon and Maisr Sheni. Maisr Rishon you give to the lady. Maisr Sheni you take to Yerushalayim and eat it there. Or you redeem it and take the money to Yerushalayim and buy food and eat it there. And the third year of the cycle, you substitute Maisr Ani for Maisr Sheni. Okay. And you give the Maisr to Aniim. You don't take it to Yerushalayim and eat it yourself, you give it to an Ani. The next 2 years, the fourth and fifth year, go back to like the first and second, Maisr Rishon and Maisr Sheni. The sixth year is like the third year, Maisr Rishon and Maisr Ani. A seventh year is Shemitah, there's no Maisr. During Shemitah, there's no Maisr, it's not yours. That's the cycle of Maisris. Let's talk about that for a second. Sound strange? If you had to give a mitzvah, and you were going to give part of what you have, sometimes you give a tenth to poor people, and sometimes you bring it up to Yerushalayim yourself and eat it there and enjoy it. Okay? If you were the Rabbanu Shel Olam, and you were commanding people what to do with a tenth of their crops, would you command them more to give it to Aniim or more to eat themselves? They're going to eat the other 80% themselves anyway. Right? We're talking about a tenth of what they have to give away. One tenth they have to give away. They're giving really two tenths and plus a little bit more for truma, whatever. But the majority, they're going to eat themselves anyway, wherever they want. So now the Rabbanu Shel Olam wants to give you a mitzvah to do something with two of the tenths of what you have. So two of the years, you go and eat it yourself in Yerushalayim. And the third year, you give it to Aniim. Wouldn't it make more sense if the first 2 years you give it to Aniim, and then if you're such a nice person, and for 2 years you gave a tenth of your crops to Aniim, God says, you know what, I'm going to give you a reward. You don't have to give it this year to Aniim. Go and eat it yourself in Yerushalayim. Wouldn't that make more sense? Instead of the first 2 years, you get to eat it in Yerushalayim yourself, and only the third year, 1 year, you give it to Aniim. I would say that the order is wrong, and the ratio is wrong. So why does the Rabbanu Shel Olam not agree with me? The Gemara says that Turnus Rufus HaRosha once asked Rabbi Akiva the following question. If your God loves poor people so much, why doesn't he support them? Why doesn't God support the Aniim? He loves Aniim, tells us to support them. Why doesn't he support them? So Rabbi Akiva told them, of course God could support Aniim. Right? It's absurd to think that God tells Ashirim to support Aniim. He gives them extra money, and he says, I gave you extra so you can give it to the Ani. Cut out the middleman. Give it directly to the Ani. If you really believe that God is the one who gave the money to the Asher and commanded him to take from his money and give to the Ani, then why didn't God give it to the Ani directly? Ella, it's not for the sake of the Ani. For the Ani, God could give him money. But it's for the sake of the Asher that we should have the schus of doing it. The purpose of tzedakah is not mainly for the Ani. Because if it would be for the Ani, the Rabbanu Shem could take care of it. But he wants us to do it so we can be zoche to be the one, to be the Rabbanu Shem shliach in helping that Ani. And that's why Chazal say, Yoser mimashe ha'asher osim ha'ani, ha'ani osim ha'asher. More than the rich person does for the poor person does for the rich person. Because the rich person only gives the poor person money, which God could have given. But the poor person gives the rich person a mitzvah, which even the Rabbanu Shem can't give you, because I call bidei shamayim chutz miyira shamayim. And that is the meaning of the following pasuk. Ruth told Naomi, when she came back from collecting the leket and shikha and peya in Boaz's field, she said, "Ha'ish asher asisi imo hayom shmo Boaz." The man I did for today, what'd she do for him? Take his money? What'd she do for him? He did for her. From there we learn, Yoser mimashe ha'asher osim ha'ani, she did for him. She gave him a mitzvah. He gave her Grain. God could have given her grain. She gave him a mitzvah, which even the Rabban Shem couldn't give him. So therefore, the main thing of tzedakah, therefore, is not for the sake of the ani. It's for the sake of the asher. With that, you can understand that it's possible for a person to give tzedakah and not get a mitzvah. If he does it, the sefer panim yafos, the sefer panim ra'os. He begrudgingly gives it. So he has no schus. What did he do? He gave the ani money. Okay, God could have given the money too. The main thing is avas chesed, that you love to do it. That's when you get the schus. And therefore, the Rabban Shem is like this. The ikar over here is not that the ani should get. So the first 2 years, so the ani won't get, I'll take care of the ani. But I want you to have the schus of doing it b'simcha. So we're going to train you to be happy to give that ani that tenth. How? The first year, I'm going to tell you what to do with a tenth of your crop. You think it's yours. But if it's yours, you can do whatever you want. I'm telling you no. You have to take it to Yerushalayim or redeem it and bring the money to Yerushalayim. That means I could tell you what to do with your money. It's not yours. It's mine, and I can tell you what to do with it. And you can enjoy doing what I tell you to do with your money. Bring it to Yerushalayim, eat it, enjoy it. Next year, Chazara, review that. After 2 years of getting in the habit of doing what the Rabban Shem wants you to do with your money and enjoying it, now the Rabban Shem says, I have something else you can do with your money. Give it to an ani and enjoy that too. I once gave money to somebody that I wanted them to have something for Yontif. And I found out that they gave it to tzedakah. So I went to them, I said, what did you do? I wanted you to have that. I wanted you to have that extra simcha and Yontif with that money. Why'd you give it away? He said, that was my simcha. I gave it to somebody, and I was really happy that they had a good yontif. I felt like 2 cents. The person obviously was on a much higher madriga than I was. But that's what the Rabban Shem wants. The Rabban Shem says, the first 2 years, you can enjoy doing with your money what I tell you to do. You get the idea that it's not your money. I can tell you what to do with it. If that's the case, if you practice that for 2 years, the third year, it's possible that you'll give it to an ani and you'll enjoy that too. And that's what I want you to do. I don't want so much that the ani should get, because I can give him. I want that you should enjoy doing it, that you should feel good about doing it, because that is the reason why I gave the mitzvah of tzedakah, not that the aniim should benefit. I can benefit the aniim. But you should benefit them, and you should get that schus. That's the idea. Okay, now, so the halacha is that if you fulfill all the mitzvahs of Trumas and Maestras during the 3 years of the cycle, you give Truma, you get Bikurim properly or whatever, all the mitzvahs that apply during those 3 years, at the end of the 3 years, in the fourth year, Erev Pesach, according to some shitas, you say what Chazal call Vidui Maeser. Torah says, you come to the Beis HaMikdash. After you've given all the Truma and Maeser to whom it belongs, you don't have to give it every year. You have to separate it every year. You can't separate from 1 year on another. But you have 3 years to take care of it. 3 years to take care of it. In other words, you can put it in a silo and save it up and not give it to the Kohen or the Levi till the third year. By the end of the third year, you have to get it all out of your house and make sure that it was distributed properly. If you did that properly, then in Erev Pesach of the fourth year, you come to the Beis HaMikdash, and you make the following declaration. Bi'arti HaKodesh Min HaBayis. I removed all the Kodesh things from my house. The Gam Nesativ LaLevi LaGer LaYosom LeAlmona. Right? I gave it to all the people I'm supposed to give it. The Maaser Rishon I gave to the Levi, and the Maaser Sheni I ate in Yerushalayim, and the Maaser Ani I gave to the Ani. Lo avarti mi mitzvosecha, I didn't transgress anything. Velo shachachti, I didn't forget anything. Osisi kechol asher tzivisani, I did everything as you told me to do. Okay? That's the declaration you're supposed to make. You know what Chazal called that declaration? Vidui Maeser. The confession on Maeser. Okay? Now, I don't know, but that doesn't sound like a confession. That doesn't sound like vidui. I mean, if I come Yom Kippur and say, Rabban Shalom, okay, here we go. Time for vidui. Now, I looked over the whole year, haven't done anything wrong, haven't forgotten anything. I did everything you told me to do. I confess I'm a tzaddik. That's vidui? It may be true, but it's not vidui, right? What kind of vidui is that? They should have called it hachrozas meiser. Something, not vidui. What kind of confession? What are you confessing? So I heard in the name of Rabbi Soloveitchik from Yeshiva University, Zatzal, a nice pshat. He said, it says, Osisi kichol asher tzivisoni. I did just about what you told me, not kol asher tzivisoni. Not I did everything you told me. Kichol, just about. It's pretty close, but not exact. That's the vidui. You didn't say Osisi kol asher tzivisoni, but Osisi kichol asher tzivisoni. The Sfarno says another pshat. You can look it up. We're not going to go into detail. I just want to tell you my pshat in a second. The Sfarno says that if it wouldn't have been for the Chet HaEgel, every Jew would have been a Kohen and Levi. And they would have been able to eat the Trumas and Maishas themselves. They wouldn't have to give it to anybody else. But because of the Chet HaEgel, the Kohanim replaced the regular Jews. So that's what we say. I confess. Because my ancestors sinned, I had to get the Kodesh out of the house. I couldn't eat it myself. That's the confession. What am I confessing for? Somebody else did? Because it leaves a pagam in me. There's something missing in me because of that chait that was done years and years ago. And for that, I have to be misvada. I'm not perfect. There's an imperfection in me. Look at the Svarno, you'll see what he says. I'm going to say a different pshat. What vidui means. Vidui is not confessing necessarily you did something wrong. Vidui is confessing that you are responsible to give an accounting. Example, let's say somebody gave you $1 million to distribute, okay? And he trusted you that you would distribute that money for him in the way that he wanted it distributed, okay? Do you owe that person an accounting at the end of the year of what you did with that money? Even if you did every single thing right, do you owe him to come to him and give him an accounting, what you did with it? He entrusted you with $1 million. You have to come and account for it. Vidui is an admission, a confession of accountability. Rabboni Shel Olam, even if I did everything you said, but you gave me these things and entrusted me to do it, I owe you an accounting. I owe you the fact that I'm accountable to you. Even if I do everything right, I'm still accountable. It's not just that if I did everything right, fine. I'm responsible to do everything right. And because I'm responsible to do everything right and not to do things wrong, I owe you an accounting. You gave me all these things. You told me what to do with it. You gave me my life. You gave me my clothes. You gave me everything. You expect me to act in a certain way. I'm responsible to confess my accountability before you. That's called vidui. Vidui is not just confessing you did something wrong. Even if you did what's right, you confess that you're accountable to do what's right too. You're not just free. The Rebbeinu Shem gave you a body, a soul, and a million other things. He expects you to use it properly. And you owe him an accounting for what he gave you. That is called vidui. So even if you did nothing wrong, you still have to confess that you're accountable. That's called vidui maisa, confessing your accountability. Okay.